Welcome to Truthiverse, the number one podcast for free and discerning minds. I'm your host, Brendan Murphy, author and founder of The Truthiversity. As a freedom hacker and truth addict, it's my job to help you reclaim yourself from illusion and live in your power. Living in truth sets you free to holistically upgrade your entire life so you can explore infinite possibility. Join me as we hack our way to a higher evolution. Hey, and welcome. Truthiverse is an audience-supported podcast and an audience-supported Substack as well. You can find me over there on Substack at Official Brendan Murphy. And if you enjoy this work, please join the growing body of consciously evolving minds and voyage with us into forgotten and forbidden realms of knowledge. So do hit that like button, share with your fellow seekers, and if you hadn't yet, please do consider becoming a paid subscriber, whether it's over on my Substack or through buying me a coffee right here via the podcast. Also, feel free to check out my private evolutionary accelerator, Evolve Yourself, over at evolveyourself.live for the free masterclass. And of course, I do invite you to join me inside the members-only Truthiversity for all premium content, including part two of every podcast. See truthiversity.com for more information. Researching, writing, and podcasting is what I do full-time, so thanks in advance for your support. It does mean a lot to me.
All right, ladies and gents, welcome to this episode of Truthiverse. This is season five, and we're kicking it off with Justin Leslie. And I'm going to read his bio because I normally would avoid reading someone's bio, but I think in this case, it's not a bad idea. And then, you know, this will give us a quick little overview, and obviously then Justin's going to talk us through his story. He's a young dude. He's been through a lot in his life. Well, how old are you now? 26, 27?
26.
Wow. Okay. So you've been through a lot of stuff for a 26-year-old. All right. So ladies and gents, let me give you a quick rundown of Justin, then we're going to flesh it out with this. This is going to be a very interesting talk. So he is a living man, a scientist, a whistleblower, an investigative and undercover journalist, and a producer of the film Project Whistleblower. He worked directly on the COVID-19 Pfizer mRNA vaccine platform from March 2021 to April 2022. He worked with Project Veritas during his time at Pfizer for 4 months. Instead of being allowed to blow the whistle, CEO James O'Keefe offered Justin a job. This is where things get even more interesting, as you'll find out. Justin went to go to work at PV, Project Veritas, as a journalist. And he is the journalist behind the infamous Pfizer-directed evolution story, reporting that Pfizer is mutating COVID. Justin will have more to say about that. As well as the fertility story, that's fertility, P-F-E-R-T-I-L-I-T-Y, on the impact the vaccine has had on menstrual cycles. And Justin went to work at O'Keefe Media Group for about 5 months, where he ended up resigning in August. And since August 2023, he has worked on the film that tells his story, which is called Project Whistleblower, which is a tell-all documentary of what his experience was inside the walls of Pfizer and also the alternative media world. Well,
mouthful, right? Thanks for that intro, Brendan. Appreciate it, brother.
No, it's a pleasure, man. It's really great to have you here and to give you a chance to tell the story. And, you know, I'll get to hear it. Obviously, I've gotten to see a sort of advanced edition of the documentary, but, you know, I'm going to enjoy hearing it from you directly as well. So, dude, let's tell the story. Like, where do you want to start with this thing?
That's a great intro, and I'm kind of, you know, doing these pre-podcasts essentially to, you know, have an outline of everything, but every talk is going to be unique, right? And basically, I, you know, where the story starts, where the documentary starts, is at the University of Rhode Island, right, where I start off studying pharmaceutical and biomedical sciences. And so, you know, everyone calls colleges, you know, especially public universities nowadays, like, you know, indoctrination camps, right? So I went and studied pharmacology, pharmaceutics, pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, right? Whole nine yards of basically taking up my bachelor's and becoming a pharmaceutical scientist, like a bench level, introductory level to these pharmaceutical companies is essentially what I was going through. So, I mean, to even preface that and getting to why I wanted to get into pharmaceuticals is stemming from when I was 9, 10 years old, I was diagnosed with a multisystem disorder called tuberous sclerosis complex, which creates benign tumors in just about every organ of the body. So I was diagnosed much later than most people are in their livelihoods. Like most people with this disease, right? Because, you know, we can talk about viruses and everything down the road, but in this story, right? I was diagnosed with a disease, right? And was essentially given a 26-page packet, right, from this guy from Yale, right? And it was this huge traumatizing event in my life of like being told that you're different, you have this disease with this really long name, and I was just it kind of sent me into a depression when I was younger, right? Because I was like, is something wrong with me? Did I do something to deserve this, et cetera, right? And so then I discovered that I'm extremely lucky in that people with this dis-ease are rather debilitated. Like 90% of people with TSC is what it's called for short, have epilepsy, and 40 to 60% have some version of autism, essentially. So it's a really disabilitating and debilitating disorder, right? So my drive and force to go into pharmaceuticals was to get into drug discovery or into pharmaceutical sales for, rare disease and things of that nature, right? Because, that's the machine that we're kind of fed, right? But I saw good in that, I mean, I didn't see any harm in going to try and, create a new drug that is going to actually cure the root cause of this, rare disease that I was diagnosed with, right? So, I go to University of Rhode Island, and it's a great pharmacy program that I went through, right? I mean, I learned a lot, right? And I liked pharmacology because it was essentially, taking the drugs and seeing how it works within the human body physiology, right? And what's going on, so it's kind of like reverse physiology in a sense, right? So, I graduated URI in the midst of the COVID pandemic, right? Like when COVID, quote unquote hit, right? I was on spring break literally in, what was it, 4 years ago to like in 2 weeks essentially in the midst of March. And it was just, I started asking questions right away. I didn't think, oh my gosh, this is a sham, right? But in that time, like nobody really was prepared for, a quote unquote pandemic or plandemic, like I call it in the film, or scandemic, like you like to call it, right? So, from Fort Lauderdale, graduate, do Zoom University at University of Rhode Island for the last 3 or 4 months, essentially, and was pretty miserable doing that, and was like, this is basically a waste of time, right? And then, so I was applying to master's programs, or I mean, pretty much just Rutgers, because I wanted to work with a professor, Gabriella D'Arcangelo from Rutgers, on my, dis-ease, right? TSC. She had this massive research paper on like the mTORC1 pathway involving TSC, right? So this is all prefacing, and so I took my Rutgers acceptance and said, hey, I'm gonna go to Rutgers, because I couldn't find a job right out of school, which was, I mean, I was obvious, I was looking for a job, but I just couldn't find one, and so, once I started at Rutgers, it was Zoom University again, right? I didn't realize that until I already sent my deposit in, and I thought I was gonna be able to do research and stuff and, stay on campus maybe, but they're basically saying, you're stuck doing this on the computer until the vaccines come out, basically. And so, I was already asking all these questions and researching into, the COVID-19 fraud, essentially, right? But I was like one of maybe two people in my entire program that was actually questioning the narrative to, like I have one friend from this program that I haven't even finished, right? Because I mean, we'll get to that in the timeline, but so, first semester was essentially like M1 school, like a master's M1 medical doctorate, coursework, essentially, right? Studying all these biomedical pharmacology again, and, not getting to the root cause of anything, and I'm just like, this is just regurgitating what I was doing at University of Rhode Island. I'm not learning anything new, and this whole thing literally seems like entirely questionable. Like I watched the documentary Plandemic 2, and so I wrote up this entire uncovering of a report essentially for my drug discovery class for Dr. Welsh, who I thought was super cool. Like, he was a really nice professor, right? But I wanted to challenge the narrative as best as I could, right? And literally, watched Plandemic 2 and took all of the patents regarding, everything shown in that film to like corroborate it. And then I put it into a paper, and it essentially, lines out the lockstep agenda that we were up against, right? And so, I mean, it started with Carrie Mullis, and the PCR test, right? I mean, all of us truthers and, people that are, have looked into this understand that the PCR test ultimately is a sham, and that once you get up to 35, 40 cycles, it's a joke, essentially, that they used this test like they did back with, the HIV AIDS scam as well, so.
Manufacturing cases.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty absurd, and so, I mean, I highlighted Carrie Mullis talking about how Fauci is a fraud essentially, and I mean, a lot of people can see it. He's literally called Fraud Chi, right? Is his nickname.
Fausty. Yeah.
So there was Carrie Mullis, and then also highlighted Dr. Scott Jensen, who was a senator from Minnesota. Where he literally was highlighting how, he was encouraged to make COVID deaths like written down, even though, if this person tested positive like 2 weeks, if they find out that someone dies from a heart attack or some sort of pneumonia, right? But their son had, COVID 2 weeks prior or something, like, oh yep, that's a COVID death. And it was just a huge sham, and incorporated that into the paper as well. And highlighting Event 201, essentially how they talked about a coronavirus outbreak in October of 2019, right? And like, it just coincidentally happens like what, 4 or 5 months later. And that's kind of happening right now with Disease X. It seems like they're just buttering us with predictive programming for the people who, I mean, we're definitely way better prepared for something like a Disease X, I think, as in terms of humanity. But there's still a lot of people who are gonna fall for this narrative potentially, which is why I'm, doing what I'm doing and want to speak out about all of this, So that paper, was part of my journey, part of my awakening process. And then I was, like I said, completely miserable during my Rutgers master's program. And so I said, I'm going to find a job and utilize my skills as a scientist, right? Because if I'm this miserable, why would I keep doing something that I'm not enjoying? So I pretty much just enrolled in one class instead of what it was like five or six that I had to take, right? So I was just a part-time student. And so I applied to several pharmaceutical companies, and I went through multiple interviews. So it's not like I didn't even like reach out to Pfizer slash this Mylance company, right? They called me, right? So Mylance Incorporated is a consulting firm that, hires people for pharmaceutical companies, right? So, I mean, my LinkedIn was open, and these people called me and said, hey, there's this role in Andover, Massachusetts, if you'd, if you want to apply, essentially, they might hire you, right? They're looking for people. I'm like, oh gosh, right? And so I wasn't even aware that I was going to be working on the vaccine until the interview itself, right? But I knew it was for Pfizer as a contractor, right? And so, I look back to that first and even the second interview, and it was I mean, it was professionally done, but it felt like lackadaisical almost of like, I don't even feel like these people are going to hire me. Like these people have way, they could totally hire somebody else, right? Like there's no way that it's going to happen, right? Like I thought it was kind of a joke, and they offered me the position after the second interview, and it was literally just two phone interviews. Like they didn't even see my face. They didn't know what I looked like. And so, I got the call from the recruiter saying they're offering you this position. And I said, you gotta be kidding me in my head. Right. Cause I literally, to even backtrack, like when I was in this master's program, like waking up to the vaccines and the dangers of them. And essentially, we're both friendly with Alex Zek. Like I was very much on the same train of like, these vaccines are going to be mandated and like used for forced vaccines, forced vaccination. Like this is, this lockstep agenda, all these vaccine passports and everything, right? Like I was on that wavelength. I just, I wasn't all over social media speaking out about it because I was doing what I was doing. So, I essentially said, I need to really think about this when I got that phone call. And I said, I'll basically call you back tomorrow. And I had 24 hours, and the guy was kind of shocked that I didn't take the job initially, right? One of the questions I was asking is, do I have to get vaccinated, right? Like, because I basically said, there's no way in hell that I'm going to, if it's this job or getting the vaccine, like I'm gonna wait, That's basically what I said to this recruiter. And so he found out for me and he said, yeah, it's not mandated yet. And so I said, okay. Right. So at the 23rd hour that next day, I took the job. And I basically, with no intentions of having a vendetta or anything like that, right? It's literally just, I'm gonna go see this for myself and see like what it looks like and see what this vaccine looks like, see who these people are like, and just learn and use my skills for my undergraduate degree, right?
So you weren't of a mindset at this point. You weren't sort of like of that undercover mindset going into something to expose a fraud or it was something dangerous. You were just kind of like curious at this point.
I was very curious, and I knew that inserting myself into the company would allow me to expose something down the road. Absolutely. I mean, like, because there are receipts, like, in the documentary of, like, I reached out to Project Veritas, like, prior to even accepting this offer. And they're like, yeah, we can't tell you what to do, but if you find something that's newsworthy, right, feel free to reach out to us. So, I was thinking like that, but I mean, it wasn't my like dead set intention of like, I'm going to blow the whistle. Like essentially, I didn't say that like to myself specifically, like, hey, I'm gonna go, undercover essentially. Like I kind of was just like, let's see, if that opportunity essentially comes from this, right? So I took the job, I moved to Boston. And it was March of 2021, right? So boosters were almost kind of already coming into people's arms, right? Most people were double jabbed that were going to be double jabbed, right? So I had no way of like stopping people from taking the vaccine, those two first shots, right? But when I go from March 2021, essentially till I reached out to Project Veritas in late September is when they officially started working with me and like actually communicating with me. I was living in, you could call it two different matrixes, right? Like I was at work pretending literally no one knew my vaccine status. They all just assumed, right? Right. And they were like even telling me, yo, go get the booster, Justin. Right. And I'm like, this is insane, because in real time, like I was paying attention to, alternative news media of like all the myocarditis happening and pericarditis and just vaccine injuries in general, right? Like Guillain-Barré syndrome. And so, it really pains me to have been in the know, like I feel so guilty, right? Like And people have told me, like, yo, this isn't your fault, right? But I, you know, hold the weight of the world on my shoulders and feel like that there's blood on my hands, right? Because I knew between right and wrong and that this was ultimately harming people, you know? So, but I can't go back and create a time machine and, you know, do things differently. Like this is how it's all played out, you know?
I think it seems like it played out. You know, you weren't in a position to do it at that point, and it played out the way that it needed to, so that you would be put in certain positions to then, you know, ultimately, when the time was right, you would be enabled to do that, to do your thing.
Absolutely. So I had reached out to Project Veritas, in, I think it was late August, and I had a phone call with one journalist and, you know, she was just asking me questions and basically didn't think that what I had to offer was worth it. And then I basically kept hitting them up. I hit them up in early September. And then after Jody O'Malley, who is the HHS whistleblower, she had a really, you know, bombshell story out of Arizona, right? Where she was recording in her hospital and there was a doctor, I believe her name is Dr. Gonzalez, said a lot about the VAERS system and the fraud and essentially said that, you know, the government doesn't want the vaccine or like basically getting out there that the vaccine is full of shit, right? So I was like, this story is crazy, you know? So her story really like drew me to reaching out to them again, you know, and showing that, hey, like I'm holding a picture of these vials. Like I want help, you know, is all I really wanted. You know, I'm like, I'm in this position. What can I do? You know, and so like the very next day or two, right? I mean, I sent that email and then I got on the phone with the journalism team that worked with me, right? And then so they provided me cameras, right? And I started, you know, obtaining information immediately, you know, and so, you
So
know,
just
after.
to be super explicit, like clear for people, you were going into work, you were going to your job at Pfizer, like wired up, basically, like ready to record footage and that would be used.
I mean, you know, basically what I would do is cut off a button on this shirt, right? And put in this, you know, put in the camera and start rolling, you know? And so, you know, it's really, it was crazy what was happening. You know, I was like, I'm this undercover agent now inside Pfizer, right? And, you know, I'm working with this journalism team who has their hands literally all over me, like helping me, right? And I was this unwitting whistleblower, like pretty much, you know, stupid, naive, but like brave at the same time. I was like, I gotta do this for the world. You know, like that's how I felt. I'm like, I don't care if someone takes me out at this point. Like I'm gonna do this, you know, because this is what God's telling me to do, and this is what feels right to do, right? Is work with this group of people, right? So I was very trustworthy, but very naive, right? Because, you know, I was going in there every day, obtaining information, and then, you know, giving it all to them in this trustworthy sense, you know, that they're going to take this and run with this massive story, right? And it's not like I wasn't obtaining nothing. You know, I was like in the documentary, my old manager, Conwall, who is a very nice lady, she was essentially talking about how the Pfizer CEO, Albert Bourla, and Ugur Sahin, the BioNTech CEO, essentially had no idea like what was going on, right? And I was eliciting information out of her, by just talking about vaccine symptoms and, you know, how the mRNA is, you know, like this is an emergency use drug and like, why are we, you know, pushing boosters on people, right? In this country, but, you know, the other countries haven't even gotten their two shots yet, right? Just basic stuff. And she gave like a bunch of newsworthy content essentially, you know, and, you know, to outline Anything else? I mean, I can see if I can pull up the rest of the transcript, but I mean, what she says about Albert Bourla is really damning, in my opinion. Oh, she also talks about Katherine Jensen, essentially, speaking with Uğur Şahin, the BioNTech CEO, right? Because what happened is, you know, when I got into Pfizer, I discovered that they were already working on mRNA vaccine projects for flu before COVID, right? Before COVID even existed, apparently they were working on this in 2018 and 2019, right? And so the problem is, you know, and if you look into Moderna is literally like a project slash company, you know, created by DARPA, right? The military, right? So Moderna went like 10 years being a company without being able to put up a project, a actual product, right? Because they were strictly Moderna is mod RNA, literally like in esoterica, right? Like you can move the words around and it's mod RNA, right? So that's what their product and projects were. And so Conwell goes on to even say, like, you know, we, as in Pfizer and Moderna, were using this mRNA platform during the emergency use authorization of this COVID-19 scamdemic that we have come to see in order to get through it now, is the quote essentially. So, you know, to get through what, the pandemic, or get through, you know, the crazy symptoms that happen from these mRNA injections, right? So, you know, I thought it was pretty ridiculous that this was a conversation I was happening while in real time Pfizer was reporting, like, get your booster, the vaccines are 100% safe and effective, this and that, right? Like, you go back to the news cycles and see what was said, it was different from what was being told to me, right? So I thought I was doing the right thing still, right? Like I'm traumatized, literally. So that was October 6th. And then if we want to stay with the timeline of everything, I provided vials to the team, right? I said, you know, I started seeing things like about people glowing on alternative media websites like BitChute and it's linked to this enzyme called luciferase, right? And so, you know, this whole moment in time has also, you know, brought me closer to God and looking into the Bible. And, you know, I'm not a religious guy, I'm more of a spiritual guy. Like I like using scripture for spiritual reasons, right? And, you know, just hearing the word luciferase, it's very esoteric in regards to what was happening at the time, right? Like if this thing's making people glow, right? And you're hearing about, you know, this, you know, this is being mandated and you're not going to be able to go into grocery stores, or you're not going to be able to travel, like just ripping away your rights as a man or a woman, right? But that's not the reality of the world that we live in, right? We have to stick up for our rights and stand up for our rights as men and women. You know, we can't let the so-called authority tell us what is right and wrong, right? We are supposed to be their authority, I suppose, right? So, little tangent there, but yeah, so I discovered luciferase in research studies and things of that nature in animals, right? So, you know, seeing that, I'm like, oh, this people are glowing on the internet. Something seems incredibly wrong. And then, you know, hearing about graphene oxide and that potentially being in the vials and the vaccines, right? You know, I just wanted to get to the bottom of what was happening, right? Like I was probably the only critical thinker that Pfizer employed during this entire thing, you know, I mean,
Sounds about right.
or one of, you know, I'm sure that, I mean, there were other people I think that were not vaccinated because, I mean, I had to ultimately go to work. Like, I complied for a little bit and essentially taking this PCR test. It wasn't one that went up my nose. I essentially just had to spit into a cup. So they have my DNA basically, right? So there's probably like a, you know, we can joke about this, but there's probably a clone of me already.
An obedient, compliant Justin.
Well, yeah, so I complied with that, but I mean, I was like, there's no way I'm taking this vaccine, you know? Sorry, we're tangent off of the whole vial story, but to finish up the how I got out of getting vaccinated even is my contracting company worked with me versus my colleagues. Anyone who's considered a Pfizer colleague was, you know, their manager saw their vaccine status, literally, right? So my manager didn't have access to mine because I was just a contract employee. So I was just dealing with one person from outside the company, right? And when they told me about this mandate that was coming and that I had to get vaccinated, I was like, dude, I'm going religious exemption and you can literally like kick rocks, right? Like if you try and make me get this, I'm gonna sue you, you know, is what we're gonna get into. And so they never questioned that after that, right? So, you know, I stood up for myself, right? But for all the other colleagues, it was definitely an interesting point in time, right? Because I mean, no one necessarily like put this thing in your arm. You kind of, you know, you had to stick up for yourself. And, you know, if it meant walking away from your job, that's what it ultimately was leading to, right? So there's class action lawsuits and everything happening from all of the mandates and, you know, the tyranny that we saw during that time period, right? But yeah, I'll finish that tangent. And so back to the vial situation, right, with Carrie Madej. You know, I provided the Veritas team with, you know, this product, the drug product, and we went all the way down to Mamaroneck, New York, and Carrie Madej was there. I recognized her from Stu Peters, right? She went on the show, you know, probably just that week prior, right? So I was super excited to see her. I was like, oh, this lady knows what she's doing, right? And so, you know, literally she brought the Johnson and Johnson and Moderna vials that she had already pre-examined from another show that she was on. But this whole thing was going to be part of a massive expose of, you know, look at what's in the microscope or what's under the microscope, right? And so, you know, Johnson and Johnson and Moderna, she looked under those first because we literally had the Pfizer vials were frozen, right? The entire way down, right? We made sure that they stayed a certain temperature. And so they had to thaw. And so we just looked at the Johnson and Johnson and Moderna. The Johnson and Johnson specifically looked different from Moderna and Pfizer, right? Moderna and Pfizer pretty much looked identical. Pfizer might have looked, you know, we're splitting hairs here, but they basically looked very similar, if not the same, right? Johnson and Johnson had these like black discs all over the place. And so, you know, I'm just wondering, like, what the heck is this? Like, what is going on? This does not look normal or real or like something that should be going into people's arms ultimately, right? Like this seems like a bioweapon, right? Is immediately what I'm thinking. And on the Stu Peters show, there's, you know, a black disc and then there's this little parasite that even like swims around the black disc, right? So, you know, as a 23-year-old kid, young man, right, working on this on one of the vaccine projects, right? I wasn't working at J&J, but to have seen what I was witnessing, right? I didn't even know what to think. All I knew is that this was a horrible crime against humanity, ultimately, right? And so We did Johnson and Johnson for whatever, like 20, 30 minutes, probably moved to Moderna and then moved to Pfizer. And, you know, if you watch the Stu Peters expose with Carrie, she provides pictures of the vials and, you know, what she took from that night. And so there's the talks of like Teslaphoresis essentially, and these carbon nanotubules that are being formed in people, right? Like essentially the way I look at what this vaccine is it's some form of a drug delivery system that is going into people and like forming these clots that we're seeing, right? These very unique blood clots that have started since the vaccine rollout, not since COVID happened, right? If you look,
Unprecedented since the vaccine rollout, absolutely.
right. So, I mean, I'm not here to fearmonger people, right? Like that is not the goal of this whistleblowing situation because, you know, my goal is, you know, just to really get to the bottom of what happened, right? And it probably can't be done by just me alone, right? But speaking out about this stuff as somebody who worked at Pfizer on the vaccine, I hope that people will listen and hear what I have to say and plead for a massive investigation into these shots, right? I mean, it's crazy what I was witnessing, right? So, yeah, I mean, Dr. Carey goes on to talk about how, you know, in the show, it's potentially hydrovulgaris, right? And I'm not backing that these vials had like this water parasite essentially called hydrovulgaris, right? Which is like a, it's like a, it's got to do with the transhumanism agenda where, you know, organs and limbs like regrow themselves like lizards kind of. I'm not backing that up, right? But I'm not saying, I don't even think Carrie will back that statement anymore. Ultimately, I think, you know, it's kind of been debunked, but we can narrow down that in regards to the way that the patented technology of these drug delivery systems and then the ingredients of the vaccines, right, are lined up pretty much perfectly, right? So you have these lipid nanoparticles, ALC0315, right, in Pfizer, and then Moderna's SM102, right? And these all have to do with this drug delivery system ultimately that leads to, you know, the clotting of these heavy metals in people. And, you know, I'm no expert at really explaining this, but I've done a lot of digging and research into it. And Dr. Anna Malhalja from she's from the End of COVID, and I've watched all the End of COVID series for like the mRNA injections, right? So Dr. Anna Malhalja and then Dr. Anna Maria Oliva both had very interesting sessions, and I see a lot of truth in both of them, but you know, with Dr. Anna Maria Oliva, I think her session really does a good job at not necessarily fear-mongering, right? In explaining that what is in these vaccines is nothing that's necessarily new, right? It's, which is true, right? It's just, you know, the way that she was able to outline how there is graphene in saline already, right? Like on a, and graphene's basically in everything at this point, you know?
It's
So,
everywhere. Yeah,
right. So that's the whole thing about this fear mongering of graphene oxide and everything.
and can I, if you don't mind, brother, like hold that thought, and I want to let you keep going. I've got Anna Maria Oliva living like 2 Ks down the road from me with, and we've got Adam Bugleson in town as well, so I've had the benefit of like learning from these guys, and you know, Adam's like the godfather or the son of the godfather of, you know, holographic blood. And it drives him crazy when people talk about Anna Malhalja, because she is, in some respects, I won't say all, as you know yourself, in some respects she's got a number of things quite wrong. And it drives him crazy because he's like, look, she's pointing at a hologram here in the blood and saying it's graphene oxide. And then I'm like, you're right. This is okay. This is a hologram. And she doesn't know because she's very inexperienced with a microscope. And then what I really like with Anna Maria Oliva is, and this is why I interviewed her as well for the podcast, and I called it Truth Is It's Time to Get Off the Fear Carousel, because she's, like you said, really good at explaining a bigger, broader picture where we take away the unnecessary fear and just kind of get a bit of perspective on it. Like you said, graphene's everywhere now. It's not new in, you know, we've not been able to prove it's in any of the injections, but it's definitely in the environment everywhere, and it has been for quite a while. So I just want to interject that, like, when we're talking about microscopy, what I've learned from Adam is people need to be quite cautious with what they're seeing other people make claims about, because you don't necessarily, we don't know what their level of expertise or experience might be. And then, you know, I finally meet with Adam and talk to him, and, you know, I've spoken many hours with him, and I kind of get now where he's coming from and why he finds it so frustrating when people are like, Adam, I said this. And it's like, it's a hologram. Yeah. Stop it. It's a hologram. You know, like, so there's this interesting mix of we have to be discerning and figure out, like, and most people are not in position either to like have the expertise to go, oh, well, that's right, but that's not right. That's, they just see a doctor and they go, well, they must know what they're talking about. So, okay. Yep. Like, whatever you say kind of thing, you know?
Absolutely, brother. And I mean, I'm not pointing the finger saying like Dr. Anna is, you know, doing this on purpose, right?
No,
and
no,
this, the fear mongering and everything. It's just, I mean, I've looked into it and I mean, her and I forget his name, but I mean, it's not important, but they essentially treat these slides with oil. And it distorts the sample ultimately, you know? So, this was just one night of my life, right? But it was a nightmarish event ultimately, right? With Dr. Carey and looking at these vials and, you know, I mean, it really was nightmarish, Brennan, right? Like, I mean, there were these, you know, shards and, you know, things that were moving in the J&J vial and like things that look like water parasites, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, I felt at the time like, hey, this is really not looking good for Pfizer, right? Like this looks like a huge, huge mistake. And like, what am I even watching? You know, so, you know, we looked at the vials for like four something hours, I think, and it was getting late. So I had to go to bed. Right. And so, you know, they propped me up in a hotel. Right. I hardly slept because, you know, I didn't know what I was looking at, you know, and, you know, so I woke up at like 4 o'clock that next morning to go to work. Right. And continue working on this vaccine that I just saw was like moving around and had this telomerase stuff and, you know, these things that look like spider webs and this neural network essentially that Carey Madej describes.
Can I ask before you go on with the story there, when you're going to work at Pfizer, what is your like brief or job description? What are you working on there?
So I was hired as an analytical formulation scientist, right? So I was working for the pharmaceutical research and development team. It's called PHRD, right? So we had a relatively small team, right? And it was a small scale environment, right? So we really had like one lab to ourselves, right? We had like three benches, right? And I was given the role, you know, to get trained up on some analytical drug assays, right? So there's ribogreen, which is a fluorescence assay, fragment analyzer, HPLC, which I wasn't really doing, analysis of like visual analysis, like just looking for, you know, against a black wall, right? Mm-hmm. Like analyzing if there's any threads or things like that in the vials, right? So but it was mainly ribogreen and fragment analysis were what I was doing a lot of, right? And it took me a decent amount of time to fully get trained. It took me like 4 months to really become competent, right? First job out of college, and I just, you know, not that I wasn't working, I just to be like fully competent, it took me a while,
What in
So.
yeah, and in the context of like in the context of the vaccines, the Pfizer was working like, you're working on the ribagreen and the other thing. What does that mean in terms of the context of the vaccines?
In regards to like what the manufacturing process and like how close I was to like the actual finished
Yeah,
product.
I'm just trying to, pull all that together and paint a picture for, because the lay people, those terms aren't going to mean much.
So the best way that I'll do my best in describing it is I was in research and development, so I wasn't working directly on like a manufacturing building, right? So I wasn't working on finished drug product. I was working on research, right? So we had a fabrication team, right? Which their job was essentially to make small scale batches, right? Of whatever projects they were working on at the time, right? So, you have all of these stability studies, right? With COVID-19, right? In the midst of the scamdemic, right? You have to show all of the stability and show, mRNA integrity, mRNA encapsulation, show the concentration of what's in these vials, right? So, there was apparently certain mRNA contents in each one, right? So I would run a ribogreen assay, say once a month for a stability study, right? Or run, if it was like a new formulation, say that they were testing, it would literally just be run the ribogreen, run the fluorescence assay, which is able to test for the percent encapsulation and test for the concentration of the vials, right? So does that make sense?
I think
And
so.
then,
So all of this work was all focused around vaccine formulation.
yes.
Okay,
Yes.
cool.
So vaccine formulation, new stuff, and then stability for formulations as well, right? So like we had, the vaccine was already going into people's arms, right? So we were continuing from an analytical perspective, looking at, the shelf life of the COVID vaccine, right? And we would even do it at certain temperatures, right? We would, minus 80, it was like minus 20. 2 to 8 degrees, right? That all these different temperatures for it was mostly the new formulations, but I mean, they did stability for basically everything. They had to cover every aspect of, being a scientist, right? That's what you do. You test at all of these temperatures, which, and I also thought it was really ridiculous that we were working with freezers that went up to minus 80 degrees Celsius, right? I'm like, what drug product needs to be frozen like this? That was just something I was always asking, So, yeah. So that answer your question
Yeah,
there?
thanks, man. I don't want to harp on it, but I just
Yeah.
wanted to kind of paint a picture of what was going on there on, on the daily for you and in the context you were operating in.
Yeah. I mean, I was in the lab like most days, and it was essentially like small scale manufacturing so that it could be ramped up to something that's much larger, right? Because, I wasn't working with like bioreactors and things of that nature, right? Which those things are huge, huge tubes, right? That, I don't even really know how they work, but I know that they're big, massive tubes, right? And that, they hold a ton of drug product, and that's what manufacturing really has a lot to do with, So small scale stuff, I was only dealing with like vials and tubes essentially, and we just threw everything out for the most part, right? So yeah, the whole vial thing happened with Carrie. And going back to work, I continued on, right, doing what I was doing, right, obtaining information on the inside, right? And so I continued, say, talking to, in the film, Ramin Djawari is featured, who is my manager's leader figure, her boss, right? And he is a formulation scientist. And so one day I was talking to him in the lounge area, and it was just me and him in this open space. And I just started asking him from a real world situation that, my mother had a friend who knew somebody else, right? Like her mother's therapist friend is, I think, what I say in the quote, but bringing up how somebody died essentially from a booster shot, right? And he addresses how the only booster shot on the market right now is Pfizer, right? And then he basically deflects off of, well, correlation does not equal causation. People die every day, right? Like you could take the vaccine and then get run over by a car, essentially, is what his deflection was. And I mean, I was probably the only person in my building and probably on the Andover campus that really was like, it felt like asking these questions of, like people are dropping dead, right? Like, and we're just rolling out this experimental vaccine and it's basically a worldwide clinical trial. Like, what is going on?
And he didn't seem to be thoroughly enjoying that conversation. There's only a short clip of it. I remember you asking him that question, and I hearing his voice go, "Other people die every day." It sounded like he really wasn't open to pursuing that on any level.
No, yeah, and I think that's because he just didn't want to incriminate himself, right? In any sense, right? Because I mean, he was one of the head honchos of this vaccine and how the formulation played out, right? So, yeah, it's I was eliciting him on safety issues, and for him to essentially say that it's not our job to worry about like the clinical aspect, right? He's like, the clinical people, that's their job to worry about like adverse events and people dying, right? And then he goes, yep, there was zillions of reports every day, right? And I wish I could go back and be like, zillions, what exactly do you mean by that? Like millions, billions, right? To get an exact definition, right? But to say that Pfizer is getting zillions of reports every day on this vaccine and having adverse reactions to it was very telling, that he
Pretty
kind of knew
damning,
something was up.
you've got him on video saying it. I remember that. That is what he said. Zillions of reports.
And then later in the conversation, we were talking about he refers to a chip company analogy,
Thank you.
which I also thought was really interesting, and so did Veritas' production team. They thought it was an interesting quote because he takes the chip company analogy, right, and starts explaining how, as a chip company, or so I listed him on vaccine mandates essentially. I was like, well, does Pfizer get mad when companies don't mandate the vaccine, right? And he's like, well, as a chip company, right, aren't you, do you get mad when people talk bad about your product? Of course, right? Like, and he's like, it's the same thing. Like, and then he goes on to explain how the vaccine is even manufactured for me to, or not the, in the metaphor, it's chip companies create chips for me to keep eating chips, right? So he's like, basically the same thing. Like, it's for me to take it again, right? And then he even alludes to that if you eat too many chips, you get heart problems and then you die. And nobody's talking about that. And so, I, in the moment, right, was kind of shocked, right? And I wish I continued asking him more about, like, oh, the chip company, is that actually like what pharmaceutical companies do too, right? But it's damning enough where, the public should have the right to know this information, that this is coming from the mouths of leaders on the vaccine, right? So, it was really absurd, right? And the next thing essentially that I believe is depicted in the film is with Nick Warren, who is the Pfizer vice president, who he spoke at the childhood vaccine approval for 5 to 11 year olds. Right. And so I was already like full blown entrenched into, doing what I was doing with Project Veritas as a source. Right. And so, I essentially set up a meeting with Nick. Right. Because I mean, these people were open to having these conversations and answering questions, especially as a young guy, like new to the company, I really, came across as this curious fellow, right? And so, excuse me, Nick essentially explained to me within the first 5 minutes of asking him after this advisory committee happened, right? I took all of these notes from this advisory committee, and there were a lot of difficult questions that were asked by this board, ultimately linking, the scenario is, it's like this bait and switch situation, right? Where people in the truth community have heard of that term essentially, right? Where, one drug gets approved, but they're really putting something else in people, right? There's the emergency use authorization, and then there's the approved Comirnaty 80, right? So my understanding of all of this is that with this childhood vaccine that was 5 to 11 years old, they did the clinical trials for 5 to 11-year-olds with a buffer system that used PBS sucrose, right? So that storage temperature was at minus 80 degrees Celsius, right? So listening to this whole meeting, essentially, I'm listening to people in the FDA and Pfizer essentially say, yeah, there wasn't any clinical data done for this shot that was approved, right? The one that has this TRIS buffer, right? So the FDA and Pfizer essentially colluded and said, we're going to allow a bioequivalence metric for this TRIS buffer approval, even though all of the clinical data is coming from a different storage temperature and a different formulation ultimately. I mean, the formulation itself is the same up until the last step of the storage buffer system, right? So, I saw that as fraudulent. Like, how are you not going to do actual clinical data on stuff that's going into people's arms, right? This junk that's going into people's arms. You should at least do clinical studies to show that this one is safe and effective, right? Going into the lingo of, we know that all vaccines are bioweapons essentially at this point, but
yep.
I'm speaking in terms of the actual lingo of what was going on, So does that make sense? What I'm saying, how they literally used a different buffer system, but the storage temperature was PBS minus 80, right? And then the TRIS sucrose could be stored at a much higher temperature, around like 0 or 2 to 8 degrees Celsius, right? Mm-hmm. So it's much colder. Or not colder, so warmer.
Yeah.
Right. So he essentially told me he gamed the FDA within like 5 minutes of sitting down with him, right, by lying by omission, right? He essentially didn't really address that the clinical data was for, was omitted, right, for this approval, So to me, it was bombshell. It was criminal and it was dangerous. Insane that, people can essentially, talk about this behind closed doors and then have it approved for 5 to 11-year-old kids and have it go into people's arms. Like, this is an attack. Like, it's child abuse. It's an attack on kids, and like, that's ultimately why I feel I have to do this, is to do this for future generations, right? Like, this is something that I cannot just let go by, like, I don't know how else I'm supposed to explain that, but yeah, I mean,
and just before you do go on, if you want, if ladies and gents are wondering, Justin has all this, the great quotes and conversations that he's talking about. He's recorded footage. He's got the footage and the audio in the documentary. So I do recommend you see it so you can, process all this with the visual aid and the audio and actually watch these people just completely, essentially expose and out themselves, these crooks in Big Pharma.
Absolutely. And then, I mean, even in that same approval meeting, Steve Kirsch, who I'm friendly with, and we can talk about Steve after this, but, Steve definitely backs up the virology narrative and He like loves the directed evolution story that I did. That's how we became friends. But
Yeah, right.
Steve did a tremendous job in the vaccine approval meeting as a speaker, lining out like people are dying from this. Like you, if you approve this, you are all criminals essentially. So I found that to be, a pat on the back for him, right? In the sense of these people were notified that this was essentially a bioweapon, a death shot, a clot shot, whatever you want to call it, right? Whatever nickname you want to call it. That's what was going on. And there was mountains of evidence that Steve presented in that expose, right? He had 3 minutes and he's basically just like, boom, next slide, says what he has to say, next slide, right? And, so it's very interesting stuff. If people want to go back and rewatch all of this, right? So where to next in the story? Nick Warren happens, and then so I ended up meeting James O'Keefe on December 3rd of 2021, right? Don't let me jump ahead too far. After the microscope thing went viral with Carrie Madej, about 2 weeks later is when this FBI raid happened on Project Veritas, right? And so I was still, a whistleblower source, right? Obtaining my all the information every day on what happened, right? And I mean, Stu Peters' video with her pretty much, you could call it viral, right? It in a year's time, I mean, over 1 million people saw it. So, enough people saw it where it's, a high amount of people, right? So I knew it was rumored, and she literally says like Project Veritas and a Pfizer whistleblower have essentially, corroborated the story and, wait for that essentially is what she says. And it just never gets released, right? And so the FBI raid happened November 4th and 6th, on Eric Cochran, Spencer Meads, James O'Keefe on the 6th. And it all felt like a huge coincidence, that like didn't line up. Like it had to do with this Ashley Biden diary situation, right? Which was also a story that wasn't published, right? And I was just like, there's no way that Project Veritas is getting raided by the FBI, and like, why is they raiding the FBI? And I'm involved with PV trying to expose this massive fraud with the vaccine ultimately, So I'm just asking these questions, and it took me a while, but like it ultimately, I will say that it feels like it was a massive cover up to shut me up ultimately, and scare the absolute shit out of me, So that happened. And then, moving down the line, right? Like I was still doing what I was doing,
At
obtaining
the,
information.
and sorry, man. Yeah, at this point in time, were you already having doubts about James O'Keefe at this point, or did that come a little
A
later?
little bit. I started questioning it a little bit. Like the FBI raid happened, and I watched live, like, cause I watched live, like I was watching Fox News, like with my dad and my brother, believe it or not. And James was on Fox News with Sean Hannity and his lawyer, right? And they were talking about this Ashley Biden raid. And I was just watching this and I'm like, dude, this is crazy because my family didn't even know what I was doing. Like they had no idea, right? I was like on a one-man mission to, find out the truth of all of this. And I'm just like, is this because of what I did? Like, is this because of me ultimately? Right. And I mean, I wasn't like, James is a fraud, right? Because of all this, but it's just one of the dominoes of this whole story, right? Does that kind of address
Yeah,
your
like
question?
I know I don't want to jump too far ahead. I want to let you kind of get there on your own time. So yeah,
Oh,
keep
you're
going.
good. You're good. So no, but that's a great question. I mean, it's definitely one of the little dominoes that started as having me like ask these questions ultimately of like, is this completely controlled? Right. So, the FBI raid happens. I still am working on the inside, and I met James December 3rd of 2021 at the Capitol Grill in Hartford, Connecticut. And I was accompanied by several of the journalists that I was working with, right? So there was Nightingale, Jitsu, and Security, right? Those are their code names. And I had actually had a phone call with Jitsu and Nightingale, or Jitsu, who was the field ops director and like had his hand essentially in like every investigation. As well as Knight, and then I think Security and maybe A1, James Lolino. We all had a phone call like 2 days before I met James, and they basically broke the horrible news to me that like your story is not going to be published, but James wants to meet you essentially. And like he even brought up employment initially, right? Like they thought I was so good at this undercover work that and they knew I didn't want to work at Pfizer anymore. So they're like, you can come help us essentially, right? So, they dropped that suggestion, right? And I'm just like, well, I could, right? Like, why not? Right? Like, I do have all this blood on my hands from working on these vaccines, right? So, it was automatically like a really difficult decision, right? And so, they're like, yeah, 98% chance we're not going to release this because of the whole FBI raid, and then because of, Massachusetts recording consent laws and everything, and which I had no idea about, right? I really didn't. And so I sat down with James. He basically explains to me that I can't release your story. He starts showing me his wrists of like how he was arrested by the FBI. And I pleaded with this man saying, dude, you have to understand that like I've worked so hard as a whistleblower source for you, and to string me along for 3 months, right? To just pull the rug on me like out of nowhere and then, break my heart, say that you can't release my story, and then offer me employment, right? He offered me a job, and I didn't know what to think, right? But like at that point, it was all out of my hands. It's not like I was keeping this stuff. I was way too trustworthy, naive, and just here you go. Like this is the whistleblower story of the century. Here you go. Like, let's do this. And it just didn't, they said no, like, sorry, but we're not sorry, ultimately. James was the final say. But, the legal team apparently had their hands all over this journalist team that was working with me. They knew every step of the way, what I was doing. So to allow all of that to play out and then pull the rug on me, it just felt like it was, something out of my control at that point. And I just was devastated, because I literally walked out of that restaurant knowing that I had a massive story on a crime against humanity that wouldn't see the light of day, essentially. So I stayed at Pfizer for 4 more months, right? Trying to essentially even, at that point, I was like, all right, I'll go apply to these other Pfizer campuses to see if I can do it again, but I knew how powerful the information that I had obtained was. Right. I knew that, and that is a huge reason why I've, gone about what I'm doing, gone about what is what, right? And what I'm doing, So I resigned from working at Pfizer in, April. Mid-April was about when I was resigned, right? I think the exact day was April 12th of 2022, right? So basically a whole year is how long I worked there. And I was miserable that entire time, right? Like and I still look at it in a sense that I have blood on my hands, right? Like I knew better than anybody else, and I have caused harm because I worked on these vaccines and I didn't say anything, right? So that's what this is all about. and doing no harm, informing the people that I worked on this product and that it is harmful and that you shouldn't be putting it into your body, right? Long story short, but so I took the I resigned, and then I immediately applied to work as a contractor, as an undercover journalist for PEV. And I wanted to look at them essentially, I wanted to work with them. Like, they were very friendly with me. They were encouraging me to apply, and there was no guarantee that I was going to get accepted, but I mean, I basically walked in there and they hired me after an interview and said, let's go, let's get you trained, let's teach you the ropes, right? So my first ever operation, you want to call it, investigation was, we did these Philly drop boxes, went to Philadelphia, learned how to do surveillance and everything, but that's not even in the film. But basically, what I started doing, right, as an undercover journalist, you have to literally like use an alias, right? So, my name's Justin, but I didn't tell anybody my name was Justin, right? I used, you could say Jason or Jordan or Joe or David or Mike or whatever, right? Like, literally came up with all of these aliases that I would use, right, on these undercover dates, right? And so, not all of my meetings were, quote unquote queer gay dates, but a majority of them were, right? So
I think we should back up a bit and just contextualize this for people, because some people might be wondering, hang on a minute, dates? What? So let's just go back one step and
we can slow
explain
down.
what was happening. Like, what was the idea here and what you were actually doing? Because you're working undercover, and I remember from watching the film that you were finding some of these people on things like Tinder, and you would
Yes.
arrange these meetings with them, like, or kind of setting up a honeypot, right? Like,
It's absolutely a honeypot is what I was. I was a male honeypot, right? So that's a lot of, in undercover journalism, the most important thing is access, right, to people, right? That you obviously need access in order to obtain information from people, right? Like, you can't, like, for example, just with my Pfizer story, I was such a great source because I had access to all of these people, right? That these people did not ultimately, right? So as an undercover journalist, your job is ultimately to gain access in some way, shape, or form, right? Whether it's with an undercover meeting, being a honeypot date, right? Or going to conferences, right? Or going to just bump into somebody on the street, you're gonna need an alias of some sort, and you're gonna need some way to be friends with this person, right? So to me, it's, the dating apps, right, that are, widely used by a lot of people nowadays, right? Like, that's how a lot of people like find friends even, and find their actual, husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends, right? Like, it's crazy how that has exploded over the last 10 years, right? So that's what my job was, to create dating apps, right? I didn't do it literally right away. It happened like a month or so in, but once I started swiping, I saw how drastic it was that it had to essentially be like these gay guys, right? Because the ratio of men to women that were liking me, that were considered subjects, right, based off of job title, right, was like 600 to 1 type stuff. It was drastic, Brennan. Like, absurd how many gay guys were liking me on all apps combined versus women, right? So it was a little demoralizing. I'm like, wow, like, this is crazy, right? Like, I literally had everyone. There's a setting where you can have men, women, or everyone. So I even had transgender people liking me. And, dude, as a journalist, like, you literally have to like look into everybody, right? So I mean, It's, you know, as funny as it is, right? Like I would like message with these people to find out if they're drag queen and that if they're like reading books to kids type stuff, right?
Right. So you're working, this is quite broad. Like you're not just focused on the Pfizer and the pharmaceutical thing. You're also doing, it's a little bit more broad. You're doing other sorts of tasks and jobs as projects as well.
Well, that's an interesting question because my take on my aliases was always like with an alias, you want to be able to speak to something that you're comfortable with, right? You don't want to, like, I didn't want to use an alias on, like, I don't know, some job that I know nothing about, right? I essentially said I was in like pharmaceutical sales and I could just BS that and be like, oh, I was just hired for like 3 months ago and you know, I don't really know much. So yeah, tell me all about your life. Right. Is, you know, just the short end of it. Right. So I always had my aliases. I mean, literally, like, here's even a business card of one of this, like this guy, Jordan, right?
Did you like sort of come up with like a list or a short list of people you wanted to target for, conversations?
We don't use the word target. These people
Sure.
were subjects, right? Where,
Subjects, okay, yes.
I mean, where there was a system essentially that we all used to, we were all essentially unique in how we found our subjects, right? But, all I really was looking for is job title, right? And then once you see the job title, right? If it's like, if someone's saying that they work for Facebook, right? Openly on this app, they're probably going to have a huge mouth and talk all bad stuff about Facebook, right? So, you know, whether it was Facebook, whether it was Pfizer, whoever, right? I wasn't specifically looking for Pfizer, but since I had worked for Pfizer, I was obviously on a Pfizer beat, right? So I was looking for Pfizer people to sit down in front of and get a story on them, right? So I, you know, we can get to Jordan Walker in a little bit, but I'll introduce the story about Funeral Fun. Funeral Fun was a investigation that myself and a senior journalist went to Tennessee to a funeral directors conference, right? So there were a lot of people involved with the funeral, how do we put it? The funeral economy or the funeral world, you know, like just people all involved with funerals, embalmers, funeral directors, you name it, right? So myself and the UCJ that I was working with, he was a senior and we had pictures of blood clots, right? That came from a source who was an embalmer for over 10 years, right? So not some just dude who's been cutting people open for a year or two and is starting to ask questions. Somebody who's extremely credible, right? And so this was in 2022, right? We were asking all of these embalmers, all of these funeral directors that were part of the Tennessee Funeral Directors like association, what's going on with these clots in people, like, you know, trying to get information out of them. And I didn't really get anything great, right? But you know, it didn't work out in Tennessee, right? But the fact that we had these clots, right, from an embalmer was very, very, interesting, you know? And so the same journalist I was working with went to another conference and he did obtain some footage that felt releasable. I didn't save that footage. So, you know, this is just by word of mouth, but, you know, that footage didn't see the light of day. And, the PV board of directors, months after the investigation, essentially said that, you know, we don't want to publish this information because it's too conspiratorial, essentially. And, you know, this isn't newsworthy content, basically. Right. So, you know, that just had me questioning a lot of things because, hey, I was coming from Pfizer and I'm seeing all this stuff about myocarditis, blood clots, all these neurological disorders and these vaccines that like look like worms essentially are just coming out of people. These embalmers are cutting people open and pulling out 3 foot clots. Like, what's going on? And why are we not gonna at least raise questions? Right. That's my thought process. So, it was pretty crazy. So there was funeral fun, and then even before the Jordan Walker story was this story on Ed Camp Long Island, where I showed up as a master student and started going to these professional development sessions, and the first one was called Pronouns, Bathrooms, and Flags, basically. And this professional development group was all about, like, introducing people on how to, practice affirmations with kids and, do pronouns and things of all of that nature, like with this LGBTQ ad agenda, right? And it just was pretty crazy because I ended up meeting another subject. There was Alyssa Waters and then Dave Casamento. I met Dave in this session, and I met with him twice outside of this investigation, or outside of the school, right? And he told me that his sexuality essentially had a lot to do with how he like created connections with kids, right? And so that was a really powerful thing to say as an assistant superintendent. And
That's
so
crazy.
that one was a huge one, and there was even a parent who like freaked out at the, there was a huge uproar from this story ultimately once it was released in March of 2021, after there was this LGBTQ teach session of an ed camp where it literally was a whole professional development day centered around LGBTQ and like accepting all of this stuff. So the first ed camp session I went to back in October had just like one of these type sessions basically, right? And I was looking for content in regards to DEI, to diversity, equity, inclusion, in all the other sessions. And then I find out in March, 5 months, 6 months later, that they have this entire session, right? And every professional development session was ran by a student, a teacher, somebody who was in charge of, practicing this way of, DEI essentially, right? So, I don't want to talk too much more about that, but
There
it's.
was some really interesting moments in that around that in the in your film, man. The David Casamento stuff, you got him saying this on camera, stuff that just would make the skin of any parent crawl.
Yeah.
And it's so damning. They just completely wreck themselves. You just fed them enough rope and they hung themselves. But the David Casamento thing was interesting. Was there any more, you feel like is connected to that? You want to mention it all before we get into the next bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, that whole story literally, I mean, I wasn't even ready to go into this investigation. Like, I didn't have an alias or anything ready, but it was just given to me, like, when I got there from my colleague. He said, "Oh, your name's Dave. Like, let's roll, show up as, this bisexual guy." And at this point in time, I haven't touched on this yet in the interview, but I pierced my ears literally to become across as more effeminate, right? So I pierced them both, and then after like a month, I took this one out and I kind of just rocked the one ear. And like I was demoralized by these earrings ultimately, like in my real life. And the fact that I had to wear this for my job, I didn't have to, but I did it because it just felt necessary, right? To become a more effeminate person. But yeah, speaking on Ed Camp specifically, I mean, it, self-described from like people at PV, it's, coming from a more conservative leaning area too in Long Island. There's like 60, 40 is the percentage of, conservatives basically. So this was an area that we knew like would have impact if this stuff was ultimately going on. We received a tip on it and we just went and investigated, and, we did nothing wrong. These people said what they said, and that's that, you know? So the fact that there was such a huge reaction from the parents at East Meadow was really rewarding. And then Alyssa Waters is at Jericho. And then Manhasset is where this guy Don Gately was at. And, you know, I patted myself on the back because it was a, you know, investigation well done, it seemed. And, you know, Dave, unfortunately, you know, got reassigned and retired. And, you know, he said what he said, right? And I didn't put those words in his mouth, right? He told me all those things, you know. So, yeah, so that whole investigation actually happened like with the Jordan Walker story happening in between. So that happened in around October for Ed Camp. And then I got introduced to Jordan Walker, by the Bumble dating app, right? So my, colleague slash work friend, Carrot is his code name, Carrot Top. He found Jordan Walker in Queens in that area, right? So, you know, he got swiped on, I think, by Jordan, right? So with Bumble, you can literally share a profile with somebody, right? So I thought, hey, how cool is that? He found a subject for me and he's going to send them to me. 'Cause I mean, everyone that I was working with knew that I came from working at Pfizer too, right? Like I was known as the Pfizer insider who became an undercover journalist at PV, right? So, Carrot shares this profile and we hit it off, right? I liked him, right? Or swiped on him. He swiped back on me and, you know, hit it off in the text messages, exchanged a phone number with him. And then we went to, you know, a restaurant, right? For our first place to meet. And I really didn't say much to him at first about much of anything. I just was rolling with an alias and I knew he was going to be a good subject coming from Pfizer. So I really didn't want to like scare the, you know, what out of him initially, like, oh, like these vaccines are killing people, da, 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 right? Like, and I mean, if it was just me versus like dealing with a filter almost of the under, you know, for the company that I was working with, I probably would have had a different conversation with the man. But I basically was reserved for the first 40 minutes and then work came up. And then, you know, I asked the infamous question that went viral. So Pfizer is ultimately thinking about mutating COVID. And then Jordan goes, well, that's not what we say to the public. No. And then he goes on to explain how, you know, they're working on some, you know, they're doing some like mutations with monkeys and things like that, right? With no evidence, right? Like no evidence whatsoever, right? Just coming from his mouth, right? And I mean, yes, we did OSINT, which is called open source intelligence, right? To make sure that this guy is who he says he is, right? And, you know, I found his LinkedIn page. It said he worked for Pfizer, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it's very interesting to see that people after this came out, like this guy, George Webb, has written an article essentially that Jordan Walker, like, might essentially be a plant almost, you know? So I'm not saying that's true. I'm not affirming that, right? But I'm a critical thinker and I, you know, literally question everything at this point, you know? So who knows, right? But so Jordan Walker, I had about a, like a little 3 or 4 minute cut down from my first meeting where it was essentially just him talking about Pfizer mutating COVID a little bit. And then I went on another meeting with him, right, to kind of hammer him with this information, right? Which is where he goes on to explain more about the menstrual cycles that was also in a second release, right? And goes on to explain how, you know, the FDA and Pfizer were in bed with one another. Essentially, we talked about briefly about Scott Gottlieb, who is he what came from Pfizer and then became the, or it was vice versa. I think he went from FDA to Pfizer, right?
Right.
And it's just, he called it a revolving door essentially of corruption, right? And said that this is bad for the public, right? So the story itself, you know, I did the journalism. He said those things to me, right? So in real time, I'm like proud of myself, like, oh, wow, he said all this great stuff to me. But I also knew that Pfizer's mutating COVID was going to pretty much explode on the internet, like before it was even released. I just didn't know how big. And I also was conscious to the terrain model at this point in time. It took me a little while, not that long, to get to the conclusion of viruses aren't real and don't cause disease. But, that moment in time to me was more of like a gradual occurrence of like, it's not like one specific moment in time where I can point to, but it was kind of around the time of, meeting James and then like leaving Pfizer. Like in between there, I was kind of just like questioning, 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 so.
Which puts you at odds with a lot of those types of people as well. Like even if James wasn't controlled opposition, a lot of those people who are well-known faces in the alternative media are very much on that bandwagon where they're pushing the gain of function nonsense and the virus stuff and just not going to the deeper levels of actually dismantling the whole thing.
Yeah, agreed. Which, I mean, don't get me wrong, the story definitely like woke people up in a sense to pharmaceutical corruption, right? Like, boom, bombshell, James O'Keefe, Project Veritas, Pfizer's mutating COVID. Like, it literally like woke up my brother, my father, right? Like, to some corruption that goes on in the big pharma realm,
Yeah,
right?
everyone
So,
needs an entry point, right? Everyone needs that something that gets them in.
yes, but also you and I are the critical thinkers, and it's like once you hear this story, it's like, dude, this story is dangerous, right? It literally, in my mind, was dangerous because it's reaffirming at a subconscious level on a massive, massive, like, I don't like to say global, but like a global scale, right? Of this thing went and saw 50 million views within a few weeks. It reached Japan, it reached Germany, it reached Russia, China, all over. People literally were like redoing skits of like James sitting down with Jordan, right? And we call it an SI, surprise interview. So Jordan stands up and is like, right, like, what is going on? And like he broke James's iPad, and it that went viral too, like the whole story itself just blew up, out a bigger proportion than I even imagined, And so, me being me knowing about terrain, it was like really hard on me because like I just didn't even know what to do or say because I'm like, I'm being manipulated and like this is my story, but like James is like dancing around saying that Pfizer's mutating COVID, like with no evidence. And, it screamed that there was like some higher agenda still, like he would never interview me, right? But he'll let me go on an undercover meeting, right? With a quote unquote Pfizer director, even though, he calls him a Pfizer executive, right? That's something that also gets misconstrued is that this person was an executive level person, which is like vice presidents, right? He was reporting to a vice president. So under that. And it didn't sit right with me, Like I was proud of myself. Like I got a big story, bigger than I could even imagine. It's literally like they were literally saying the biggest story ever, right? Is what people were saying like on this Twitter spaces, right? And it broke my heart because I knew that terrain was the model that is true versus germ theory, and to hear Robert Malone on my story talking about gain of function narratives and just reaffirming all of it on a subconscious level to me was like, it was bad. I'm like, this is not my integral divine axis, right? This is way off of it, right? Shifted off of it. And I know that this is wrong. You know, whether these people know that it's wrong or not, I know it's wrong, you know. So, yeah, I stayed at Project Veritas for a few more months, right? So this was released in January of 2023, right? January 5th is the official release date. And they followed up with the fertility story a week later. And then the whole, I don't want to, you know, affirm the term charade, but it, what happened with the PV board and James leaving was very suspicious, right? This whole thing did feel like it was almost coordinated, right? Because like this whole Pfizer story brought up James even saying that, like, oh, we can make money off of this. We could get thousands of subscriptions and et cetera, et cetera. Just talking about money when I was worried about like the genocide that ultimately was happening from Pfizer. Like this vaccine was still going into a ton of arms, right? It was only 2023, right? I mean, a lot of people have stopped, but it's just, you know, more breaking of the heart type stuff, you know, where it just doesn't sit right. And so, for my train of thought, the whole James leaving PV and dealing with this letter that had to do with the board and then Dan Strack, the COO, right? Like the whole thing kind of just felt like almost coordinated in a sense. You know, and in real time, it just, it, that's what it felt like. And I can't prove any of that, you know, I really can't, but it just, you know, from my opinion, it felt like it was this charade in a sense of, you know, people are lying about certain things and, you know, James essentially just left on his own, but people say he was fired or vice versa. You know, like no one really knows what happened. Like James did this big speech that, you know, went viral on YouTube. Tim Cast broke it and he talks even about me in regards to the Pfizer story, says a board member called him to his home. The board member was saying, oh, you had nothing to do with the Pfizer story, James. And then he's like, well, yes, I did. I recruited this person, remember, over dinner, right? For hours, right? Which was a lie. He literally was there for 40 minutes, get a bowl of soup, recruited me, and left.
Yeah, yeah, that and that part in the film, like there's you've got the footage of it where he's saying, you know, into a microphone, I had to talk this guy down off the ledge, and we were there for hours. And I was
ledge.
like he was there for hours trying to do you a solid kind of thing, which is just complete nonsense.
Yes, 100%. I mean, because it's also a lie. He was there for less than an hour, right? And he, yeah, I mean, they talked me down a proverbial ledge, but it, like, I wasn't on a ledge. It was like they were on a ledge that, like, I, you know, I said, hey, like, here's another story, like, publish it, right? And, you know, it's just, you know, this crazy, crazy misconstrued thing, right? Where, you know, I wasn't talked off a proverbial ledge. I mean, the ledge that would have happened would have been me essentially just blowing the whistle without the evidence that I essentially had to reobtain, right? So, with the Jordan Walker story is where this whole thing flipped upside down, right? In regards to like getting my story back, right? 5 days after is about when I actually got some footage back with the Conwell Gill lady.
And can I just interject very quickly? When you talk about getting your story back, people are like, might be wondering why, because you had been feeding, you've been giving all of your data and information to Project Veritas, and they were keeping it, you know, wherever they were keeping it. But it wasn't, it was no longer in your hands. And then there was a point in time where you no longer had access to it, and you essentially almost had to redo the whole investigation, reinvent the whole thing, kind of.
Yeah. So that's a pretty good way to put it, Brennan. But yes, I gave them everything. You know, I was too trustworthy. And I was naive, right? I was like, dude, I don't need to save this, right? I mean, I had my own laptop, but like it was already full with other crap on it. So I was like, all right, I'm just, I'm giving it to these people, And I mean, it's a lot. It's a long story, but like I didn't have a hard drive to put this information on. I was not tech savvy at the time. And, it kind of bit me in the butt because if I did save it, then I would have just had it myself. Right. But I didn't, I was way too trustworthy, So, yeah, that's essentially what I had to do is play quid pro quo in the sense. And that means like you gotta give them something to get something back, right? Well, I had to give them this massive Pfizer story, Directed Evolution with Jordan Walker, right? That was a bombshell, right? James's best story ever, right? Project Veritas's most well-known story in order to get this information back, right? And I didn't ask for it. It kind of just popped up out of nowhere, where boom, I got an AAR one day. AAR stands for After Action Report of a cutdown from footage on, the inside of, my former employer, Pfizer. And I screen recorded it and kept it and said, holy, you know what? I was like, God is good. I was like, how did this happen? And it was just a miracle, literally. My colleague who was working with me on the inside had sent it to me and I saved it and I said, okay, it exists, right? Like it's real, and I looked at it, watched it. And, what's cut into the documentary is, I mean, I have a full length version that I can also release, but, it's really powerful what my manager was saying. And so, I got it and I was like, okay, I have something, but I need more, right? And I wasn't for like greedy purposes or anything, but like there's got to be more, there's something else, So I didn't really obtain anything from PV, like in regards to footage still after that. But when I did get this footage, I wanted to corroborate like where else is this information? Right. So right before I knew that I was going to leave, right? Because I knew I was going to leave at some point. Once James resigned, I basically said, I need to go take a job with James if I'm offered a job because I need access to him to continue the corroboration of this story ultimately. So once I knew the job offer was basically on the table, right, and I knew that I was going to resign. It was just a matter of pulling the trigger on these certain things, right? So I sat down with one of the producers who was at the Microscope expose, right? And his name is Mike Villani. And there was also Jazz, codenamed Jazz, Michael Juarez, who is the PV Source Insider department head, basically. And they both knew what I was doing 100% on the inside, right? They knew everything, basically. I mean, not as good as the journalists that were specifically working with me, but they were in the know. Like, Villani was a producer who cut down the 9-hour footage of A to Z of lab to the apartment where we looked at all of the stuff, right? So I elicited information out of him essentially at a bar, and he started talking about how he took that footage after my story off of the server and put it onto a terabyte drive or a hard drive of some sorts that was in the hands of outside counsel, right? So I got Villani saying that, and Jazz was, Jazz is a quiet guy, and he was kind of just nodding in agreement and, saying that, this stuff was real. And I even asked Villani, like, dude, imagine if my insider story was released or, whatever it was that I elicited him on in the doc. But he's like, dude, don't even get me started. 'Cause like anecdotally, Villani told me that like what I was doing at Pfizer was literally his favorite story ever. Right. He's like, it's awesome. It's freaking awesome is essentially what he's put into words. Right. So I was on, done with Volani. I called Volani right before I resigned, essentially. And then I called Dan and explained, or I started off asking him actually where this hard drive was. I was like, where is it? He
Where's all
said,
your information that you've been feeding them for months?
yeah, exactly. I was like, just where is it? I want to know where it is. That's all I really had to ask the guy. And he's like, legal as it. I'm like, okay, inside or outside counsel? And then he goes, outside. Why? I'm like, oh, well, I just want to know basically. And oh, by the way, I'm resigning. So, I go to OMG literally like the next day or two, right? And I actually obtained more information that following day, right?
And OMG is O'Keefe Media Group for anyone who's not already familiar.
Yes. So, when I leave and go to O'Keefe Media Group, OMG, I obtained the Ramin footage, and I was again like, God is good. This is crazy. Like, how did this just fall into my lap? So, I made sure that I got that, as well as there were some transcripts that I obtained. And that was all that I needed at that point. I was like, okay, I have a story now. Like, I got my footage, got some of my footage back, right? And so in the corroboration of everything, I mean, there's a conversation where I have with Nightingale talking about the Nick Warren information of gaming the FDA. And even my conversation with Volani spiked Nightingale to bring up how this whole terabyte conversation even happened, and I was able to corroborate that. I just was on a mission at that point, and it was, maybe stupid in a sense, right, to do this, but I felt that there was an injustice done to me, and thus an injustice done to the world, to not let this information out there, regardless of whether I get attacked or not. I had to remove, I don't want to use the word karma, but it felt karmic in a sense of like, what was happening. You knew the harm that was this was causing to people, so you have to do something about it. And I really tried super, super hard, right? But
Absolutely, you did.
everything happens for a reason. So, where are we in the story? So I mean, there was the blood clots, and then I mean, I also got we showed the vials with like granulations from a source who I left anonymous. They had sent that information actually, where they were basically just saying these granulations are coming from people that are vaccinated, and like non-vaccinated blood doesn't exactly look like this. So I've looked into it, and it is a thing. It's just less common, I think, than these blood clots. But ultimately, it all really just goes back to these drug delivery patents, essentially, that are out there, right? And have the same ingredients as these vaccines, right? These quote unquote vaccines, right? And I'll even, in like I've seen, or I haven't seen the episode on the end of COVID, but I'm friendly with Amanda Vollmer, and she and I had a conversation where, even though that there is this drug delivery system essentially being, patented and put into people, right? The human body is brilliant and is really good at basically making sure that this stuff doesn't actually happen or come to fruition, right? Not saying it can't happen in certain people, right? People can manifest this thing even, even if you didn't take the injection potentially, right? Like, but that's not to say don't take the toxic poison, right? So that's one of the things that, you never saw the blood clots and then the granulations, and then we just discussed the hard drive. I had to corroborate that as best that I could. Elaborate even more on the hard drive. There is an article that was published by the Connecticut Sentinel, which was published after I resigned, right, from working at OMG. So we're jumping ahead a little bit in regards to all of this, but the context fits, where this article basically says that James O'Keefe had evidence that big pharma, higher ups were talking badly about vaccine efficacy and safety, right? Which back in 2021 would have been an incredible story, right? To come out with this type of information, right? The vaccine hesitancy on a massive global scale would have went through the roof, like at least 20%, probably like 80 or 100, whatever estimation there is. I don't know, because it didn't happen the way I imagined it, right? But in this article, James O'Keefe essentially talks to a board member who apparently is the source who provided these communications to this journalistic company, Connecticut Sentinel, saying that, there's this. He goes, "Anything in M yet?" says this board member, and M stands for my code name, Microscope, right? And James basically sent him a 5-minute cut down, said that there's this newsworthy content. And the board member goes on to say, "Wow, just like what I've been saying, that this stuff is, there's no research into this essentially, and there's, all these side effects that are happening and from the mouths of these high up people in pharma, right?" And then James' response to that was, "The risk is high to publish," right? And that was November 28th. And then he met me like, what, 3 days later, 4 days later on the third, right? Or 5 days later, right? To tell me that we're not telling your story. So it was, back to that, it was super heartbreaking. And, I just, it's horrible that this has played out the way it has. But, so back to, I'm going through the script a little bit so I don't lose all my train of thought. But yeah, left PV to OMG, and I started working there, same type of role as an undercover journalist, but like we were all wearing different hats, where I was more of a source manager too, right? Like I was fielding tips, fielding information from sources, where at Project Veritas, I really didn't deal with sources, right? I wasn't reading the PV tip line and going through James's Twitter and things of that nature. So I had more access at OMG, which was definitely a blessing, right? Because it led me to the other whistleblowers that are part of this documentary, which we can get to now. So in May of 2023 is when I met Kim Witczak, who is a whistleblower, and she's been a whistleblower for a while, but her story is not like publicly known, and she had more essentially to share than what was public. And, she just wanted to draw attention to these documents. And, has this really gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching story, right? So I flew to Minneapolis to meet Kim, and she has mountains of documents, basically. So I was just chilling with her at her house, like scanning all of these documents and putting them into my phone, And she and I were talking about, pharma corruption and everything, and she got to her whistleblower story of how Chantix, which is a smoking cessation drug, had a black box warning on it, for years, right? I forget the exact year that I was given a black box warning, but for those who don't know, a black box warning is essentially like just this huge red marker on, a drug label that basically says, caution, this has these types of side effects, watch out for violent tendencies, suicide, et cetera, right? Like whatever horrible side effects would come from it had to be labeled, right? So in 2016, for the first time ever, there was an FDA hearing or approval meeting to remove the black box warning from Chantix. It's not like the formulation changed or anything, right? It was literally just, oh, we're going to remove this because it's not necessary, right? And so Kim was on the committee that was supposed to vote for this, and she was taken off of it for this vote and this vote alone. So it's very sus, right? Because she would have voted no and potentially gotten other people to vote no, right? But so she went to this meeting anyway. She flew out to, I think it was in DC, right? And had this huge video to show people. And there were a ton of people who were affected by Chantix there as well, whether it's being, you know, domestic violence from the drugs, suicides, et cetera, right? It was a drug that had an impact on a lot of people's lives. So, you know, unfortunately, there was no success with this, you know, video being shown and everything. The drug had the black box warning removed. First time ever that has happened with a drug, right? And within 2 years, Pfizer made nearly like $1 billion in, I believe, revenue for Chantix, right? So it went from black box warning to blockbuster drug, right? And it's just this money game of pharma, right? Kind of like in the film Cornwall, my manager goes, yeah, I think it's turning into a money game, right? And so, you know, this is just another prime example of how these companies don't have anybody's best interests in mind, right? They could care less about warning you about these side effects. They just want you to take their drugs so that you're hooked in that, oh, you know, you might be committing violence against your loved one or your kids, for example. So Kim has this absolutely, you know, gut-wrenching story. And I mean, it even stems from, she calls herself an accidental activist or advocate, right? Where she lost her husband, Woody, to, he was taking a drug of, it wasn't Prozac.
Zoloft?
It was Zoloft, right? So he took Zoloft, and there's a 60-day window within the clinical trials that highlights that Zoloft is supposed to, you know, you're supposed to be like monitored within the 60-day window. And Woody was prescribed this off-label too, right? He took it for insomnia and like some anxiety-related issues, right? So it's very conflicting, right? And so Kim ended up suing Pfizer because like they literally knew that this drug was causing violent tendencies. And even, I mean, she talks about akathisia, right? Which is like your body is shaking, right? And it's like you have no control over it, right? You can't stop. So like this is something that a lot of people have to deal with. And it's something that leads to killing yourself ultimately, right? Like people shaking uncontrollably, right? Just out of, you know, like I'm not making.
It's not just the shaking too. It's like sensations of like burning on the inside, like this itch that they can't get rid of. Like it drives them absolutely, like the suffering is so extreme that, like you said, there's the solution. Is, you know, sometimes they get in such a hole with a black hole that they, you know, that's the only seemingly the only solution. And you actually highlighted that in the documentary as well. I remember, and one of these people in the system, I can't remember who it was now. You probably remember, actually said that, oh, you know, someone in this situation, you know, hey, maybe death is a welcome solution. You know, that's the kind of way they treated it.
Yeah. So when Kim heard that, she's like, my husband's dead because of this. How do you like explain yourself? You know, so she just had this gut-wrenching story. And I got back from Minneapolis, right? I was super excited. I was like, James should interview her, right? Like, we don't even need to, like, you know, all it really needs to be done is a professional interview, right? And so, you know, my colleagues were like, oh, no, like, that's not necessarily how we work. Like, and so literally I was sent to like a psychotropic pharmacologic drug conference to try and elicit this information out of professionals, right? Like medical professionals. And, you know, I even had a subject list of people that were involved with her story. But I was just one guy, and I was dealing with citizen journalists around me, right? Citizen journalists in a sense of, I mean, there was one lady who I worked with, I'll leave nameless, but she knew what she was doing, right? With what was going on, right? She knew how to elicit information out of people, right? But the thing with this citizen journalist thing going on within O'Keefe Media Group is that it seems like it's this business model that is not necessarily sustainable, but I mean, we'll see, you know, I mean, if they can keep, you know, if James is able to do it, by all means, go ahead. But it just, as a trained and seasoned undercover journalist at that time, you know, all of us at OMG were just wondering, like, why is James so dead set on this citizen journalism business model when, like, it takes up a ton of our time, a ton of our money, and it's not proven. You know, like, it was a headache for sure, you know. So I went to that conference, didn't obtain any information, and then, you know, basically I stayed in touch with Kim, but it, you know, it's not like we were texting every day or anything. Like, we just stayed in touch, and I basically said, hey, it seems like they, you know, don't really want to interview you, like they don't want to release your story. So she interviewed with the journalistic company Redacted. I forget the guy's name, but Kim did a great interview with him, like 40 minutes. And, you know, she got to tell her story finally. But, you know, I wanted to tell her story like, what, 9, 10 months prior. So, you know, it was, again, like gut wrenching. And I mean, I even resigned after that point, right? When she got to tell her story. But, you know, I'm very happy that Kim got to tell her story. And I'm sure that, you know, she knows kind of what I've been up to at this point, and is a supporter, you know, of what I'm ultimately doing. So Kim's story was one of the whistleblower stories, and then there's another one, Raymond Bichard, who Raymond has this really interesting story on Twitter, or X, if we want to call it X now. So the background behind Ray is that he wrote this book called The Berlin Turnpike, and he's exposed a lot of human child trafficking rings. Berlin Turnpike is his, you know, big heavy hitter because it's his book, but he also has successfully done what he essentially presented to James with Facebook/Meta. Right. Oh, back yeah. In 2012, he got 400,000 signatures on a petition, and like 1.2 million people followed the movement, to the point where Mark Zuckerberg essentially had to address this problem of like pornography. And then it's more than just pornography. It's the search engine aspect of being able to take certain search terms and plug it into these social media platforms, and anything and everything really can come up with when there's no age verification system in place, right? So it was really a simple fix with Facebook. You know, Ray did this petition, and it successfully got the attention of Mark Zuckerberg, and it did well. Like, within a year, it was, like, up to par kind of with what you would expect, right? And it's just a simple fix. Like, they use a Microsoft age verification face scanner, essentially, that can essentially just catch whether somebody is 12 or looks like they're 18, right? So getting to the Twitter part, I, you know, met with Ray in person before I even, you know, brought him to James. And heard out his story, and he starts showing me all of this, you know, information of like this, you know, essentially child pornography, the pornography, and then how it can be used in as a predator, essentially, right? Where you take all these search terms and you take the search filter off of Twitter, right? Where anything can essentially show up. And then you can start typing in like non-con, which means non-consensual, or like hashtag rape kink, right? Hashtag nude teen, which, you know, there are way worse ones that you can even type in, but those are just examples. And so Ray has this story essentially called Clean Twitter Now, right? Where he is, you know, you could pull up his Twitter profile. He's literally calling out Twitter for, this childhood abuse system, essentially, right? And so I brought Raymond to talk to James, right? And this was after even hearing from my colleagues, Jasper and Nightingale, that this was a story, right? Like, they were like, this is great. You know, like, James should interview with him. So I literally drove with Ray, you know, an hour to New Jersey to interview with James in person, right? And James really was conflicted before the interview. He was essentially concerned about optics, apparently, with Twitter, and you know how he has a friendship with Elon Musk, apparently, and you know that's documented on the internet just from, you know, him tweeting about Elon commenting on his stories, right? Always makes that known, right? So I knew that there could be some conflict of interest in James's mind, but I wanted to see what would happen ultimately, right? And so Raymond affirms that there is probably zero chance that Elon Musk does not know about this information, right? Because these, you know, these links can be shared, and, you know, Twitter is potentially making millions, if not billions of dollars off of this, right? And some of these accounts are thousands, tens of thousands, even some of them have like hundreds of thousands of followers from sharing child pornography, right? And some of the links, like link to Chatterbait or other streaming devices or platforms that, you know, abuse happens potentially, right? Where it's just this open source search engine at this point, and it's where predators could essentially find their next victim. Like, a 7-year-old can make a Twitter account and change these search settings, and then boom, they're subject to all of these predators. So, it's also lined out in the interview with James that they are clearly, breaking Twitter's own policies as well, right? Especially the non-consensual one. Like, there are pictures of, you know, women with like guns to their head, and then, you know, they're doing the thing, right? Of, you know, getting on their, you know, they're, you know, it's essentially a non-consensual, whether it's acting or not, it's like really subject to being questioned, right? So Raymond has this really powerful story as well. Considering Nightingale and Jasper also saw it as a story, but then James said there was no smoking gun of any substance, and that he wants to avoid talking about this sort of stuff in general. It just didn't sit right with me again. You know, it's like, hey, this, to anybody with like common sense, it feels like that this is a massive story, actually, you know. And Raymond, it also is also very credible, right? It's not like he's just some dude who's doing this. He's like, he's a human rights advocate, right? And he's, you know, bringing this information to me, and I work for you, so I'm gonna bring it to you. What do you think? Oh, nothing? Okay. All right. Just another check on the stick of this doesn't feel right, ultimately. So we can stop talking about Raymond and his brilliant story, but and then, I mean, that's where we kind of lead into you know, the whole Bohemian Grove thing,
Right,
ultimately.
yeah. I really wanted to get to this because I don't recall it being mentioned in the version of the doco that I've got. So I wanted to ask you about this, and maybe we can from Bohemian Grove, we can kind of like, you know, wrap it up and put a bow tie on it, and then
For
we'll
sure.
switch it if we have time. If you can hang around for maybe another 10, 15, we'll see if we've got any questions from our Truthversity
Yeah, I'm
members.
happy to answer questions if they're, I mean, I don't really know how to look and
Oh
see
no, you're
if.
right, man. I'll check on that. That's all good.
Cool.
But yeah, so yeah, going to that side of it.
This concludes part one of the show. You'll find part two and related materials in my members-only portal, The Truthiversity, the Consciousness-Raising University. This creation is the official home for all my multimedia research and entertainment content. Updated regularly, my members get access to absolutely everything I create, including full podcasts, videos, blogs, courses, audio files, live internal events, the whole enchilada. Grab yourself a free 24-hour pass at access.truthiversity.com.